This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director, Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Happy Friday. Time to look back at the last 7 days and make sense of the biggest local and statewide stories in our weekly news recap.
Tonight, Chicago taxpayers are on the hook for $25 million to settle lawsuits against Chicago police.
Place your bets. The city's first casino officially opened its doors on Saturday.
Chicago City Council voted to spend even more money to deal with the migrant crisis.
A city alderman agreeing to throw in an additional $34.5 million.
A projected $538 million budget shortfall is the newest challenge for the Johnson administration.
Here to talk about those stories, Carrie Shepherd, Chicago reporter with Axios, and Ray Long, Chicago Tribune investigative reporter. Now this week, Brandon Johnson did something that many other new mayors have done in Chicago. He announced the city's budget gap is much worse than expected. Carrie, what did he say?
Well, I think a lot of that was I inherited, which is something politicians often like to say in their first term, is that they inherited this mess. But also, you know, the mayor did make a point to say that the budget gap will likely grow because of new arrivals that he expects to cost, aka migrants that have been coming to the city. He did make a point, and I know that his chief of staff, I believe it's her title, Christina.
Passione, yes, exactly.
She has said that the Lightfoot administration was like spending an exorbitant amount on just like staffing for the migrants. He said this is probably going to grow, but it does. Basically he's saying, you know, this kind of came with the territory when I took the job.
Ray, were you shocked to hear that the budget gap is much more than what Lightfoot expected?
You mean Johnson?
No.
Lightfoot projected.
Yes. I was not shocked. I mean, this is kind of the playbook of a new administration to say, hey, there is a much worse situation than we thought it was. You know what? We may need to raise some taxes or take some other measures that are not going to be the most friendly, but we have to do it because the prior administration screwed up. That's kind of opening 101 playbook for new administrations. There are real money concerns, though, with the migrant situation. Mm-hmm. But this is something that they should be all over and should have been all over from day one, and they're still lagging behind on that. Even though they're making strides, they still are acting like this is something that, wow, we really got to get a grip on. And who knew it was going to be this big? Well, it's a welcoming city. And if you bring more people into Chicago, you bring more dollars in for schools, you bring more dollars in from the federal government, and you have a chance, if you bring enough people in, to increase your representation in both Springfield and Washington.
Mm. Well, how did the migrants factor into the budget shortfall, Carrie?
I don't have an exact number. I mean, in terms of dollar amount,
yeah, I know, or just it was about $200 million of that $538 million. So what I'm hearing, folks, is about a third, right?
Right.
Of this deficit is really pointing back to migrant housing.
And the council just voted. There was just a city council meeting yesterday, and they voted for more dollars. You know, not all did. There were your regulars who do not agree that with Chicago being a sanctuary city, some of the more conservative caucus of city council who did not want any more money to address this problem, which seems a bit like a catch-22 because not taking more money from the feds is just going to put more of that burden on us, the taxpayers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what does this budget gap mean, Ray, for some of the progressive policies that Mayor Johnson promised?
Well, I think he has to, weigh a lot of those priorities against the balance sheet. And as a result, he may have to scale back some of the dreams he had for his overall agenda. Mm-hmm. But I do think that he is taking, one thing he is doing is taking a structural, well-planned approach. At least that's what they're saying, that they're not jumping at everything and doing knee-jerk reactions. They're actually trying to work things out. We'll see if that is true, but it is a mess in the meantime.
Yeah. Well, one way that the mayor's hoping to eliminate some of this budget gap is through revenue from the city's first casino. There were about 100 people, Carrie, standing in line last Saturday morning to get in. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think our colleague in the Sun-Times, Mitchell, told me that he reported 6:30 a.m. was the first person eager to go in. And I was part of the group of media who got a preview a few days before. We had to surrender our cell phones and not take any pictures and reveal anything. And that was the Wednesday before it opened on Saturday. And then there were to be 2 days of testing the machines and mm-hmm. getting the clearance from the Illinois Gaming Board, which no surprise, really, that they did get the clearance to open last Saturday.
Yeah. Well, I mean, did it seem to you like the casino from there, from Saturday, got a lot of visitors throughout the week?
I don't have the exact numbers. I'm actually still trying to report that out because my colleagues and I went last week and we sort of each took a part of, what the experience would be. And I was really paying attention to what security is like. Bally says this is unrelated. There was a man who was shot out in River North the first night, early morning after the casino opened.
Yeah.
They say that was completely unrelated. When we were there on a Tuesday, there were about 6 cops out front waiting. There are securities obviously everywhere. It's a casino. Anyone who's been in a casino knows there's cameras everywhere.
Of course, yeah.
It was a very mild, chill crowd. I think they're still working out some of the kinks. Mm-hmm. The dealers are a little new, a little green. That was something Bally's has been touting as they did this dealer school. They teamed up with city colleges. They trained, hundreds of people. We talked to one woman who said she came to work at Bally's in Chicago. She came from Horseshoe in Indiana. One of the benefits seeing that, as you guys may know, in Indiana, you can still smoke. She was sick of that being part of her daily job. So she came over to work at the Bally's in Chicago.
It'd be different here, for sure. What does the mayor intend to use this gambling revenue for?
Well, so I don't think we know really what the mayor, correct me, Ray, if I'm wrong, what he's going to use it for. Right now, they have...
He's mentioned pensions.
Yeah, well, he has. That was Lightfoot. Police and fire is the goal. That was part of Lightfoot's selling this deal and getting this. Any sort of revenue they're going to make is not even going to. I mean, our police and fire, our pensions are woefully underfunded. So some might say it's not even going to make a dent in it. This is a 2-year deal at Medina, which is privately owned, the Medina Temple in River North. They have the opportunity to extend it one more year, maybe with the idea that the permanent one at the Tribune Printing Plant in River West is not finished yet. But the goal is, I think, to get into that permanent space.
Right. Well, to that point, Ray, we know construction delays are pretty common, especially with such a massive project. So, could you see this temporary casino being here for more than just those 2 years that Carrie just mentioned?
Oh, absolutely. And if it keeps going well, they may just think, we'll leave it going as a side joke.
Why not
here.
Have two?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. And then and people might go for that, too. So I think that it's been popular so far. I had a buddy who was in that line at 8 a.m.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what did
he
say?
Well, he liked it. He checked it all out. He played a little bit and got out. But he said it was a good place, and he enjoyed it. And but you know, he's a gambler too, so
that's
one of these things for sure. And I did notice myself that there's more of a police presence around there. It's not mm-hmm. just out in front of the building, but it's around in the various streets outside where they get the lights flashing. Even in the daytime, they have cops out. So they are trying to minimize any kind of disruptions that there might be there. So that's a plus.
I mean, let's remember, this was that part of the goal and sort of the selling of getting a Chicago casino since, you know, Mayor Daley has been like, we're giving all this money to the suburbs, the riverboats there and in Indiana, bring those people here instead. And just on the Tuesday we were there, it looked to be maybe some business folks who came after work. It looked to be tourists. It did seem to be, you know, a wide range of folks.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. I mean, tourism and the surrounding stores on Michigan Avenue, where we already know that retail vacancies there are still hovering around 30%, Ray.
Yeah, it's there was a lot of kind of fear and a lot of these stores pulled out because of questions about whether or not we could keep everything under control here in Chicago. And I think a lot of that anger, part of it was generated by George Floyd and other terrible incidents around the country, has somewhat quelled. But there are, you know, historical notes about that. Why did it take so long to get this casino in Chicago when they were all over in the suburbs? And one of the reasons was because Rich Daley was in his early 2-year term as mayor, said he didn't want it. He had just been a state's attorney. It wasn't popular, or he didn't want to take a risk. And then once the others got in, it was almost impossible for him to get it back, get Chicago in. I can remember standing watching him in 1991 at City Hall, and he said, you know, reality. That was, as you'll recall, a recession period. So they thought, well, we'll get our casino in here and that'll juice things up again. But okay. The other riverboats fought it, and now we're just getting through.
Mm. All right, City Council has been busy. Let's quickly just go through a few things that they voted on yesterday. First, Alderman approved one of the largest police settlements in years. What are the details, Carrie?
Yeah, $25 million, I believe, was it. I think all but a few voted for that. This is nothing new that we've seen with Chicago, trying to right the wrongs, the many past wrongs of policing that has coerced confessions,
wrongfully convicted folks.
John Burge is a name we hear often. These were a couple cops that had other complaints about them dating back to, I think this was a shooting in the early 90s of, you know, a IIT student who was also a basketball player. So, you know, Johnson was clear in saying, you know, this is what these people are owed. We need to start, you know, we need to fix the wrongs that, you know, are in the past mm-hmm. that some of these police have participated in. I think the argument from some of the aldermen who voted against it is they thought it was too high. It is the highest, I think, this year, if I recall. But we've seen these, and the city's law department makes it, the argument they make over and over on these is, you want to settle because if you go to court, it's going to cost the taxpayer even more, which is something you hear in all types of litigation.
Right.
You want to settle. That's going to be easier for everyone. So
there's always the question of what it looks like. What's the message that's being sent when you do settle?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
What are you saying?
I mean, I think often when you settle, people are assuming you're accepting wrong and culpability.
Right.
So, you know, what you'll see in a lot of big class action lawsuits, for example, is they'll settle, but they'll say this is not an admission of wrongdoing.
Correct. City Council approved allocating millions in federal funds to migrant shelters and services. What can you tell us about that, Carrie?
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue that's going. We started talking about it, and we're going to keep talking about it. The mayor last week, we heard, actually the mayor I heard, at least I think probably like many of us, from Fran Spielman at the Sun-Times.
Yes.
And then when I went to confirm those details, there seemed to be a little confusion, maybe in the mayor's office of, you know, where that. But now we are, my colleague is going to be getting that plan from the mayor's office. But we heard about these tents. They're calling them something else now, but obviously tents, these migrant tents, weatherized tents is what it was. And this is what we've seen with the temporary shelters as well, is that a lot of neighborhoods and communities are like, I don't want it. I don't want them in my neighborhood. You're seeing these, seeing that reaction in disinvested communities on the South and West Side, who are saying sort of, you know, we need this. We need these resources. We need this money. I don't think it's an either or, obviously, conversation. This is becoming a huge humanitarian crisis. The mayor, you know, Brandon Johnson, said he's looking to what Eric Adams in New York is doing. So this is meant to go to some of that shelter, some, you know, food, all of the things that just cost the house, you know, thousands of people. It's been more than, what, 13,000 migrants that have arrived since last year.
So many. Yeah. In a little over a year's time. Anything else happened at City Council, Ray, that you think our listeners have to know before we take this pause here?
Well, I just think that the migrant issue has overwhelmed the city in ways that they couldn't comprehend. And, you know, we've had 13,000 here in Chicago, but we've seen 100,000 go into New York, too. So maybe they can get a few cues from what's happening in New York. But tents are not just the answer. They're a minor piece of the puzzle that can be kind of a halfway point to help them get better lives and get settled here in Chicago.
We should note, too, in at council, Sasha, you said anything else happened, is that Bring Chicago Home is this huge, the mayor introduced
huge
that.
Huge priority for Johnson.
Huge priority. This is part of the, finally, they introduced this ordinance, and this is addressing homelessness in the city. But this also, for the everyday person that's probably, obviously, concerned with the issue of homelessness in our city, but this affects the real estate transfer tax. This was being dubbed the millionaire's tax early on. This was that, you know, you would be taxed if you were selling a home for $1 million or more. The transfer tax, you would be charged more than if you had a home for, if you were transferring a home for less than $1 million. He has since shifted on that, and it's a graduated tax. Mm-hmm. This is a lot of saying tax and a lot of confusion, but it's basically depending on the price of the home and the real estate transfer, the tax is graduated, so it's not a flat tax. Look, if you're selling a home for $1 million versus $7 million, you shouldn't, you know, the argument being maybe you shouldn't have the same tax rate.
Yeah. Do you think he's addressed the concerns of the corporations that are also hit by that too?
Well, right, because it's not just residential, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm sure they're going to have a lot of pushback, right? Because that's going to hit them hardest. I'm not sure that he has addressed them, and as far as I've seen, I don't know. What do you think?
I think there's still concerns there that, and that'll probably be the big pressure point.
Right, right.
Let's move on to politics in the region. There were a lot of Democratic VIPs in town this week. What was going on, Carrie?
So as we all know, the DNC, Chicago is no stranger to conventions. I think your colleagues, Ray, at Tribune have reported, I think we've hosted the most of any other city, Republican and Democrat, and even Republican ones, which you may be surprised to know.
Back to Abraham Lincoln.
And so this was kind of this is a dual mission. Obviously, like you said, Vice President Harris was in town fundraising for the presidential reelection in 2024, but also big wigs, big money folks were getting somewhat of a preview of what to expect at the DNC next August, which will, I believe in that clip, the house that Jordan built, I believe we're talking about the United Center.
Yes.
And then the McCormick Place on the near south side. And then, but one thing that they have said, and, you know, DNC is saying this with all across the board, DNC committee, convention committee, they're really trying to hit on diversity. So the big question is going to be, I think we heard in there, they went down to Bronzeville Winery. The big question isn't going to be how, you know, where are the parties going to be? Where are the events going to be hosted? Will they go farther west than the United Center?
Mm-hmm.
And will they go farther south than Bronzeville or Hyde Park? You know, and see, and really see and experience the entire city, but also they were talking a lot about making sure that food vendors and other vendors, that they're taking from minority-owned businesses, is they say it's really important to them as well. So we'll see.
Ray, weigh in there. What do you think the Democrats' main concerns are about Chicago as they plan for next August?
Well, there's always the ghost of 1968, of course, and that will be a play in the national narrative here. As you know, Mike Madigan, the longtime state Democratic chairman, will be on trial for corruption in April. So that is going to go a few weeks, and that's kind of a run-up to the Democratic National Convention.
Perhaps,
and of
not
course,
the run-up you want.
Yeah, right. So you've got Madigan, whose mentor was Richard J. Daley, and then you've got Daley in 1968, and so it's an easy arc for folks to make. 96, though, Richard M. Daley pulled it off, and it was a smart, well-run convention. Sure, there were a few blips, but nothing that even compares to the billy clubs and blood that appeared in 68.
I wrote about this week. Like Ray says, 68, so everyone's always thinking about 68. Mm-hmm. But I think another thing that I think we all journalists here in Chicago will be watching is, often when the national media helicopters in, I think I wrote that they sometimes do Chicago dirty and we don't like it. So
sometimes?
Yeah. There's going to, I'm going to be looking out for how they're covering the city and covering all parts of our city and, making sure, they're covering our city with nuance and not just relying on hyperbole like this is the most violent city in the world. And, that's not true. And so we'll be watching. I'll be watching that as well. Also, just, this is just a logistical, maybe kind of boring for people. But, they've been building a brand new CTA stop, the Green Line. I know because live on the west side. So, Lake Street has been closed off. The Damon Green Line station is closest to the United Center. The Green Line goes straight down to McCormick Place. That better be up and running, which CDOT told me this week it will be. It will be up and running next spring. But, the CTA has been a hurdle for the city since the pandemic. So we're going to have to make sure that trains and buses are running smoothly and that they're clean and feel safe for conventioners.
Tying this back to what we talked about earlier, one thing that Democrats are definitely starting to worry about is how the migrant situation could get worse leading up to the convention. By then, it'll be 2 years since that first busload arrived, right? And we just talked to Carrie, just talked about the plan to move migrants into these massive tents. What is that going to look like at the time?
Well, after they're worn down for a couple of years, who knows? There could be concerns that it's going to look like a Hooverville situation. Mm. But the reality is that I would gather that Florida and Texas governors will be shipping extra busloads of migrants to have them dumped off in front of the house that Jordan built.
Yeah.
And they'll do everything they can to try to diminish Chicago and the DNC and President Biden in the one full swing.
Sticking with you, Ray, Father Michael Flager, who's we know is the Southside Catholic priest and activist, he made controversial comments about migrants and work permits, which has been in the news for the last couple of weeks. What did he say?
Yeah, there's a lot of, Sasha, as you know, there's a lot of conversation about migrants get here, then they don't have work permits, and thus they're kind of jammed up for 6 months or more, and it's a clog in the system. And Father Flager said, hey, let's make sure that this is done right. So he took a piece of context that a lot of people aren't thinking about and expanded on it. And he said, if we rush these through, we may be setting up a situation where migrants are pushed into jobs that pay only $5 or so, or they could be taken advantage of. They work all day and then get paid a few dollars, or they could be taking jobs away from African Americans who have been struggling to get jobs in this city and now have got them, and some of them are $15 to $16 an hour. And we don't want the migrants to undercut the jobs that it took so long to get. Mm. So his if you just listen to one sentence, let's wait on this and make sure that we are doing it right before we get work permits out, you may think, well, he just is not looking at the big picture, but actually he's looking at a larger picture.
And he's responding to the fact that Mayor Johnson and Governor Pritzker, you know, joined forces,
right
and trying to get sort of fast track these these work permits.
And St. Sabina, where he is pastor, also has as many as 50 migrants there in his facilities too.
I didn't know
so
that,
that's that's an important point, too.
What do you think, Carrie? Do you think he raises an appropriate point there about the potential for migrant labor to be exploited?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, all labor can be exploited. So for perhaps or at least getting proper, you know, going through the government and, you know, there are day laborers all over our city that aren't, don't have proper protections. And that's not just about being unionized. This, you know, that's lots of workers. So, and there are a lot of, this is something that the restaurant industry, as my colleague Monica Ang has been reporting, has been pushing for. And as Ray says, without employment, it's harder to get residency because you don't have a permanent address to provide. This would move things forward a bit, and that's kind of why the governor and the mayor, I think, have been pushing. But what Flager notes is what we're seeing, like, as I said earlier, in the same issue of where to set up temporary shelters and these tents. It's this battle of we see this as finite resources in these communities. And if you're taking them for here, you're taking them from me. And it's hard to disagree with that for a lot of these communities that have been so disinvested in over the decades. And so, you know, as Ray says, he's in Inglewood and St. Sabina. I mean, this is maybe what he's hearing from his congregation.
Well, also, Sasha, you got to remember about how some of these migrants are treated and how they think they are being mistreated. As the 21-year-old Venezuelan woman over in the 8th District in Chicago Lawn, West Lawn area protested and got arrested because she couldn't feel that they were getting enough bathroom facilities. And it's not hard to understand that. The report, I think, Black Club reported that they had locked
the
door.
They were sharing a single portable toilet outside for days.
Yeah. And that they put a sign that the bathroom inside was not available or had been damaged somehow, and they weren't available for use. So, you know, let's treat the people right. They've walked through Venezuelan jungles to get here and to escape persecution at home, and we are supposed to be a welcoming city. Let's wear that label correctly.
Yeah.
Does it seem clear tensions are rising among migrants because of their lack of appropriate shelter up to this point?
I mean, we have seen incidences. I think the last time I was here, we were talking about one maybe, you know, down by the Harold Washington Library. Some of the migrants who'd been staying there around the corner, and then there were like 50 migrants staying at Harold Washington. There seemed to be some sort of fight or scuffle there. There were also migrants there that were giving haircuts. They were trying to make a buck, and they were arrested for not having proper permits in the city to conduct it. So, yeah, I mean, this is what a humanitarian crisis is, right? If people don't have their basic needs met, there are going to continue to be problems. And, you know, as Ray says, we are a quote unquote welcoming city. However, there are some people who disagree that we should be a welcoming city we're actually practicing being a welcoming city. So, you know, I think those tensions are going to continue to flare.
It's one of those deals where if you're going to talk the talk, then you ought to walk
the walk. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, people disagree on almost every point. This is a very big contentious point.
Yep.
Ray, this is why we called you. We're turning now to the former chairman of the Democratic Party of Illinois. Your story about Madigan made national headlines.
Well, this is one that we had written about in August, and it was part of a wrap-up to the Tim Mapes trial. This has several layers. Unfortunately, I'm going to go through them now.
Sit tight, everyone.
First, Anita Dunn. She is a Biden operative. She is a person who worked for the hotshot SKDK PR firm
in
D.C.
Good job getting those letters in the right
area. Yeah, it took me a week. And then you notice I slowed down, too. And, well, anyway, she worked with Madigan to help him kind of clean up his mess over sexual harassment, where he had to toss several of his people for misbehaving and inappropriate behavior toward women. Then you have, she was doing this in 2018 and 2019. Well, during that time period, Madigan was involved in a lawsuit with Elena Hampton, who had really put the ball in motion on this whole sexual harassment mess with Madigan. She had called out one of his lieutenants, Kevin Quinn, who is the brother of the alderman, 13th Ward Marty Quinn. Kevin Quinn had been sending her a relentless string of inappropriate emails and made inappropriate advances. And she stood up and called him out. And then she claimed later that she got blackballed from Madigan's organization and sued over that. And that was going on while and so then here's the other layer. Elena Hampton was getting support from SKDK, Anita Dunn's firm, and this was in the form of getting help matching up PR help so that a person like Elena Hampton gets swamped by press calls, frankly, and needs PR help and directing her message, etc. And so we have these two layers of SKD going on at the same time. And this all happened to come out during the Tim Mapes trial in an email exchange that said Madigan had hired SKDK and met with Anita Dunn. And this was like a revelation to Elena Hampton and her PR person, local PR maven Joanna Klonsky. And they thought that this sounded like playing both sides of the issue. Mm-hmm. So as a result, later this week, we were pushing to do a deeper story. We wrote a few paragraphs and a bigger story about this and like a Sunday wrap-up on the trial in August, and had mentioned all these conflicts, but we kept diving and digging, and we eventually kept asking questions to SKDK, and this last week they apologized. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of puts a new light on their whole arrangement.
Yeah, oh my goodness. Your thoughts, Carrie. I mean, how unethical was it, you think, for this PR firm to work for both sides in this situation?
Yeah, I was going to say, at the least, it seems like a conflict of interest, because Elena Hampton was working. I think she was getting help through Time's Up, which is, you
Time's
know,
Up Legal Defense
Legal
Fund.
Defense yeah. Fund, yeah. Fund, and that is Time's Up started coming out of the many Me Too allegations. But yeah, how disappointing, you know? I mean, she like, talk about the Madigan organization is very powerful, as Ray's book title says, the Velvet Hammer, right?
Yes.
And so she was kind of, it was a, you know, David Goliath here. And so she needed some help. And then I think also I don't know how she feels, but I would feel like, wait, do you even really believe in what I'm trying to fight for here if you're actually playing the other side of it? Do you believe in the justice that I am owed? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's really disappointing. And Anita Dunn's a big name. She's been around for a long time. I think she's been around since Obama.
She currently advises President Biden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, some might say her work for Madigan undercut the Me Too movement, as we've been talking about. So I'm also curious how damaging you think this is for the president.
Well, I think they wanted to get rid of it. I mean, I tried to get a hold of Anita Dunn. I tried to get some comment from the White House. Mm-hmm. They didn't give me any. Good source close to Madigan said he was unaware of this conflict. But the key thing here, I think, is that SKDK did not disclose to opposite ends of the sexual harassment issue that they were working on these two different issues,
right?
And there is overlap.
Yeah. So Republicans, you think they'll jump on this?
I think they'll throw it into a variety of their, you know, onslaught against Biden. And, you know, it'll be in the mixer somewhere.
It'll get in there somewhere.
National Republicans, that might be even a little in the weeds for them. But also, I'm sure that many Republicans like to just say Madigan, and that's it for them.
Well, you know, Elena Hampton said if she had known this, this, she would not have signed up for the money from Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which SKDK helped get for her.
I want to switch gears here a bit. Libraries throughout the city and suburbs, they had to close on Tuesday and then again yesterday. Ray, this is super scary stuff. Tell us what happened.
Well, it's some digital threat that they got that was a bomb threat. And so this is something that you can't ignore. They shut down libraries all over the city. They shut down them in the suburbs, many suburbs. And it's too bad because people need libraries, and the whole thing is coming to a head after we have a ban on funds from that was passed by championed by Alexei Giannoulias, the Secretary of State here in Illinois, who said, you know, if you're going to ban books, we're not going to send you state funds. Mm-hmm. And so that has mushroomed. He spoke, as you have noted, to the U.S. Senate committee and about his plan. And these threats started rolling out here shortly after he spoke. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, the timing here, Carrie. I know that, you know, as Ray said, he was testifying to Congress. And
Senate Judiciary Committee, correct?
Yeah. Right, yeah, and some folks may wonder the connection. Yeah, he's actually the official state librarian.
He's a state librarian. Oh, a lot of people don't realize that the state, part of the Secretary of State's many duties. It's not just the DMV, as he will tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
We actually talked to Secretary Giannoulias. We had an Axios event on Wednesday. He was, he had basically just come from those hearings, which went viral. I'll let you look them up yourselves on that from the Senator John Kennedy. Not that one, obviously. In Louisiana, had some interesting moments with the secretary. And you know what he told us is what he told you guys, I think, the last hour. He is a child of immigrants, and the library was where you went to learn, and this was free and available to you. And he said as a parent, this became a very critical issue for him. And, you know, I heard him say to you guys, he's depressed about it. Like, it seems very sad. So, and he did say as he was on the plane coming back from the hearing, he started hearing about these threats at libraries.
Yeah. Yeah. He talked about Illinois becoming the first state in the nation to essentially ban book bans, which goes into effect on the 1st of January. Here's a little bit more of what he had to say to me earlier this morning.
This right to read legislation will remove, hopefully, the goal is to remove pressure that librarians have tragically had to endure over the last couple of years. And again, this legislation that we passed is important because both the concept and the practice of banning books contradicts the very essence of what our country stands for. It also defies what education is all about, teaching our children to think for themselves.
Yeah, so as we've talked about the legislation, I mean, libraries, essentially, they would be ineligible for state grants, right, if they do ban materials.
Correct.
For personal disapproval or partisan.
Yeah, correct. And, you know, something the secretary says is, you know, and I think your Kelly Jensen said this the last hour, too, you know, a majority of these books that are challenged, they're not always banned, that are challenged are LGBTQ+ books. And something the secretary makes a point of is, you know, there are kids that do need to see themselves represented in literature. We have sad, horrific numbers of suicides in LGBTQ teens. So some sort of validation and representation of who they are in the books that they're reading in the library. I mean, the other thing is librarians are not forcing kids to read these. They're not throwing them at them and saying, you have to read these. Right. You know, I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird has a rape scene in it. You know, I mean, that's what literature is. That's what culture is. It represents our culture, the ugly parts too. So he's not saying that these have to be highlighted and say, you have to read these. But, you know, I think it's an important fight that he's doing.
Be available for consumption.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, these calls for book bans, as we've talked about, right, they're on the rise, and it's not just here. It's happening across the country. So I'm curious if you are concerned that we are going to see more of these extreme tactics.
I think that's an approach,
bomb
rather.
Threats?
Yeah,
really?
Bomb threats, those are kind of ridiculous. And, you know, they're not the kind of thing that really courageous people do. And they're not really making a point other than shutting down a lot of people's opportunity to do their own studies, to reach out and get a book. And so I think it's a thoughtful approach to this. Julia Nulius plan is a thoughtful approach to counter that. Mm. We've also seen the issue of many more people running for library
yes.
district
yes.
and taking
really?
and
school
a
boards,
conservative
yeah.
Approach that, you know, banning some of these books are part of their agenda. And same thing for school
right.
boards, because they want to get taught in schools what they think should be taught only, not a broad array of topics ranging from, you know, slavery to right. How we denied civil rights over the years to people.
All right, Ray, switching gears. What a disastrous kickoff to the football season last Sunday against the Packers.
Yeah.
Are you worried for the Bears?
I'm always worried for the Bears, although I think they may have freed up my Sunday afternoons for
right.
the rest of the season. It was a lot of bad play calling, a lot of hesitance by the guy we all want to do well, Justin Fields. But, you know, I even was questioning why they didn't punt on fourth down in their very first series when they're deep inside Green Bay's territory. It was just nutty. I mean, close to Green Bay's goal line. And so they made multiple mistakes. They fell behind early because the punt didn't work out for them.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, the numbers just came up, and I was like tweeting out, well, are the Bears going to give us anything to watch the rest of the season now that we're in the fourth or in
Where's
the third
the support,
quarter?
Ray? Yeah, Where's yeah. the love?
Well, you know, I kind of fair weathered out a couple of years ago, I think.
Oh my goodness. All right, Carrie, before we go, we do have a local media story that Axios broke this morning. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's sort of a breaking. It's more just a, you know, calling attention to my colleagues Monica Ang and Justin Kaufman reported this out about Chicago Tonight, which is the longtime flagship local public affairs show on WTTW, PBS, has been truncated, essentially. And, you know, it was an hour. It used to be an hour. Ray, you probably remember. I don't mean to age you, but John Calloway was the host of it for a long time. Phil Ponce, Bob Surratt. There's been quite a few hosts. Now, Paris Schutz and Brandis Friedman hosted, who are great. They have a fantastic reporting
Friends team. Of the Recap?
Yeah. Fantastic politics team over there. But basically, the schedule has moved around. They moved it to 10 p.m., I recall, a few months ago, and then they moved it up to 5:30 p.m. with reruns at 10 p.m. So, you know, this is not a secret. We know this in radio. I used to work in radio and programming. You when you change appointment listening or viewing, it can mess with the ratings because
right.
people get a little bit confused. So now Chicago Tonight, the latest is that it will be the original Chicago Tonight, shorter, 30 minutes instead of an hour, mm-hmm. will be Monday and Tuesdays, and then Chicago Tonight Latino Voices, Chicago Tonight Black Voices will be on Wednesdays and Thursdays, and then the Week in Review will continue to be on Fridays. And, you know, management said there were, you know, expenses at play, I think probably some, you know, and people were honest, like Carol Marine, a revered reporter and journalist in Chicago who used to host on Chicago Tonight.
Yeah.
Said this is a bad idea to cut Chicago Tonight because it was much like public radio, you know, people go to hear interviews with politicians there that aren't just a soundbite because you have more time and
right.
the politician is on your TV. It's hard for he or she to evade you so much. So, you know, losing any sort of that content is not good for the public.
Well, as regular listeners of Reset and of the weekly news recap know, we normally actually have three journalists here with us on Fridays. Today, obviously, we have two, just Carrie and Ray. That's because we did have a Chicago Tonight reporter scheduled to be here. That was our third guest. But WTTW did pull them from being able to join us this morning after this news broke. So, Ray, I got to turn to you. You've been a regular guest on that program. Thoughts on this and how it might reflect local media?
Since you've already exposed my age here, Carrie, I've been...
Sorry, Ray.
I've been on that since the 1990s. And even recently, you know, they're doing a great job with Paris Schutz having his weekly show. It makes a difference. People need to hear this. A lot of people aren't reading newspapers. A lot of people aren't listening to Reset every time. They should be, obviously.
I hope they are, obviously.
But you know, the less news that's out there in this confused world today, when a lot of people are questioning what a fact is, we need more. And we need more people explaining it. And that's what they did. I think this is, a management snafu. If they have less money coming in, it may be they're of their own making. Maybe they ought to be cutting up instead of cutting down.
Hmm. Do we know if anyone's losing their job with this change at WTTW?
That I don't know. And I don't know that I don't want to speak for my colleagues and the reporting they're doing that. But that I don't know of. And I'm not sure that they know that either. That's not something I've heard, at least just from, these being TTW people being my colleagues.
And, well, in the last minute that I have with you two, talk to us about what's going on next week? What are you focused on? What stories are on your radar? You first, Carrie.
I have some fun ones. So, Lori, let's talk fun stuff. I have some good fun stuff actually planned. I have an interview with scheduled for Monday with Matthew Cherry. You may remember Matthew Cherry's a filmmaker who did Hair Love, which won a Oscar for Best Short Film. Matthew Cherry has a new Chicago-based show called Young Love. So I'm actually getting to talk to him next week, which I think is great.
I'm jealous.
And then I also interviewed, this is kind of fun, the Cubs organist about some of the most requested songs of the organist and what he is
absolutely cannot play.
So stay tuned for that.
We'll look out for that. That is very, very cool.
Cubs are actually still in contention this weekend.
Super fun assignments, Harry. What about you, Ray? Take us home.
Well, I'll be looking for the Cubs to see if they stay in contention.
Right.
And I'll be looking to see if I can last four quarters in the Bears. I didn't quite make it last week. So, there's a few other things that are cooking. Maybe it'll pop up in the paper.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Ray Long and Carrie Shepherd of Axios. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This episode of Reset was produced by Andrea Guthman and edited by Dan Tucker and Brenda Ruiz. That'll do it for Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend and look out for a bonus podcast tomorrow morning.